Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And just like that, things change. The COVID fight continues as we're getting closer to a stimulus bill. The jobs report was mixed. And we have a great guest today, Dr. Richard Smith from the Foundation for the Study of Cycles. All this and much more on episode number 682 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome back. Welcome back to another great episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I am your host, as always, Andrew Horowitz, and thanks for joining me this week and every week. And I want to thank you for all the emails and the information that you send, all of the comments, the feedback, the ideas, the good, the bad, the ugly, and I really do appreciate that. I read every single one of them, and I answer you. And I reply to you, respond to you, and sometimes even some of the information that we utilize on the show is because of the emails that we receive directly from you. So that's awesome, and I want to thank you for that. I'll also mention there's a couple of ways to get in touch. You can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and simply click on the Ask Andrew button, and there is a quick and easy way just to jot down anything that you have in mind. You know, it's also kind of important that you provide feedback on the various podcast directories, whether it's iTunes or Spotify or anywhere else that you find the podcast. Take a second, go over there, and wherever you listen, post a review of the podcast. I really appreciate that. That helps a lot. And as a reminder, I don't think they have reviews yet, but as a reminder, we're now on Amazon Prime, as Amazon Prime Music. And this is a new platform that has come out. You can check the Amazon Music app. And if you're a Prime member, basically you have access to this. So you can download that, get free songs and all that. This is not a commercial for them, but podcasts are now included on that app as well as online. If you go to the music button over on your Amazon Prime account, you'll find that and podcasts. So if you want to listen that way, that's available as well. So I was thinking about all that's been going on right now, all the incredible amount of information that's coming out, and of course, the stuff that we heard with regard to President Trump and the stimulus bills and all the different election items, and not only political, but also economically, plus social. And I got to ask you something. How exhausted are you from this news cycle? It's kind of a hit you in the face kind of headline environment right now where it just doesn't stop. It's almost like you can't get away from it. No matter what you turn on or listen to or go to or log on to, it seems that is a continual barrage of headlines, and it's a problem because it doesn't stop. It's 24/7. It's as easy as just rolling over in the middle of the night, picking up your phone and just clicking it on just to see what time it is. And then there's probably headlines that are scrolling right on the home screen. And this has become, I think, a bit of a problem. Because I've been thinking about how difficult it is to keep up with the changing landscape, the stimulus on and off, the COVID cases that are ramping up and ramping down and falling over here and rising over there, the debate craziness that we saw. President Trump is now sick with COVID, plus his wife and several other staffers and some of the news pool, as well as some people in politics and government, and we're looking at social media news and posts from the radical left, the radical right, vote for this one. We got China tariffs. We got blacklisted companies. We got wildfires, storms, floods. Well, this goes on. Just doesn't stop. Now, let's hope this is just a weird 2020, a weird moment in time that we are seeing these kinds of disheartening, troubling, once-in-a-lifetime type of situations that are growing and continuing. Maybe it's just a dump, a kitchen sink dump from every aspect, for whatever reason that's coalescing on this one year that's just simply coming down between January 1st and December 31st, 2020. And maybe we can get back to some kind of sense of normalcy, a little more calmness. Anything's calmer than what we have now. And I've been talking to a lot of people about this. I've been talking to clients. I've been talking to friends. I've been talking to colleagues. And I'm sure that you've been doing the same thing. But what I've seen is that people are kind of right now split into two different groups. Those that are, I guess we could say, downtrodden and simply kind of depressed. They don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. They see this going on forever. It affects them personally, socially. It affects their health. And then those people who are kind of more upbeat. Maybe had a change to their lifestyle, but they're making the most of it. And I was starting to wonder, what's the difference? What is it that one group is doing and the other isn't? Or what's happening? It's not just simply, oh, one group is unemployed, let's say, and really has no prospects for income right now. That's not it, because it's kind of mixed between. Some people that are unemployed are still upbeat and have a good outlook. They think things will get better. Some people that are doing just fine financially are still freaking out. But I think, from what I can see, because of what I talk about with these people, is that one group has a focus and an obsession with the news and social media, and is creating an incredible amount of angst with them. It's causing them all sorts of heartache. And when they have their heads buried inside of this, we'll call it a news cycle, we'll call it 2020-isms, it's very difficult on them. And those that are kind of staying away from some of this, just kind of like living their lives as best as possible and not succumbing to the constant pull. It's a push, but it's a pull. Somehow this magic of media with the headline crafting and clickbaiting of headlines and the native advertising is pulling people, and it's very difficult to break that grip. And those people who are immersed in it are having the most difficult time, because it's nonstop. It doesn't end. It's constant. Whether it's by design or it just happens to be the way that it is this year, it's not the point. The point is, no, we can't ignore the news. But I think maybe what I'm learning from these two different groups is that a filtering or doses of the news, of the information, of social media is probably a better course of action. I started thinking about that also when it comes to investing. The whole idea of nose to the screen, watching every tick, watching every news item that comes out, and wondering if that has the same impact on an investor, causing extraordinary amounts of emotional damage to not only themselves, but to their portfolios, because they're not able to focus on the bigger picture. So filtering is something I was really started thinking about. I mean, if every single news item related to a company or a sector was constantly blasting in our faces, we may have a much different opinion of what the long-term prospects are for a particular company or a sector, or what we're doing with our investments. Does that make sense? We're too close to the action. We're too close to the situation, and it really clouds our judgment. So I was thinking that we need to filter. We need to step away a little bit. Just back off a little bit and think about what we're trying to do. If you're digging yourself out of a hole and you can't focus on anything else but making that profit, back to the point where maybe you lost some money in that downstroke back in March, or the recent one, or from last year, or from 10 years ago, or if you're just stuck with the decisions that you're making because somehow you just can't get off of that, and you feel that the news that you saw on this site or that social media post is negative for the company or negative for the sector, and what about those airlines? Will they ever come back? And oh my gosh, what about the cruise lines? You know, if you would have invested in some of those cruise lines at the right time recently, you could have a 30, 40, 50% return off the bottom when everybody thought they were going out of business, which they may. But the point is that the opportunities were there if you can kind of get rid of some of the noise that was surrounding all of it. So stepping away and filtering. And this is going to be especially important when it comes to earnings season. We're starting earnings season again in about 2 weeks, October 12th. The banks are going to begin reporting. And what is everybody going to be doing? They're going to be looking at the headline numbers. They're going to compare those to estimates to figure out, oh, they beat, they missed. And then you're going to see all these headlines coming out. And that's going to make you look at them because it pulls you in as they're giving you this information. And from there, you're going to make decisions, possibly sloppy, possibly good. But perhaps a better way to look at this is to step away a little bit, back up, and to look at the longer-term basis, not just the estimates that are being put forth by the analysts, but more so about how the company is doing over a longer period of time. Look at last year's numbers, the year before. Where are they in relation to those, and what's the outlook? What is the company giving us as far as guidance? What are they saying is good? What are they saying is bad? If, in fact, they are going to go back to eventually providing us guidance again, which may or may not be the case. Look back a few quarters. Compare it. Look at the fundamentals and then figure out if the only thing that you want to look at is whether they beat this quarter or missed, according to the consensus, which we know is being fed information by the company, which is going out and calculating a variety of different models on what they think it's going to be. And somehow magically, companies will beat. But then you see companies that beat that, you know, are up a few days and then they drop back down. So think of practicality of the idea of filtering, of stepping back, of looking a little less closely at what's happening at the moment, but what's happening in the big picture. And that's why, for example, we have certain filters and screens that we do for our portfolios that look quarter over quarter, year over year, and we look at trends and what's happening with a variety of different fundamental ratios and fundamental underlying levels of growth or not. And that's why we can exclude companies that are just not there. Even though they may beat numbers this quarter, their trend is off. That's why we only have a 25 or 27% net equity exposure in the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. That's why last year we cut back positioning on equities during the end of, or towards the end of 2019, holding still a substantial amount because valuations and everything we saw was not making a lot of sense. And that helped. That helped with preventing us from really getting kicked all around the place in what we saw this year, this volatility that's going on. So maybe try to filter a little bit. Spend less time focusing on the headline. Spend less time focusing on the social media, what they're saying, or these random websites that have opinion pieces rather than research. And see if it helps you gain a better perspective with what is going on, not only in your life, and maybe it will make you feel a little better. Think about maybe turning it off until the end of the year, all the different news items that you have constantly, you know, moving around. Try to maybe avoid some of the social media because they are trying to just sell ads. They're trying to attract you and pull you in on a continual basis. And that's why I thought it would be great to have our guest today. We're going to talk about behavioral finance. We're going to talk about the TikTok deal. It's going to be interesting. And our guest today is Dr. Richard Smith, and he is the founder of the Foundation for the Study of Cycles. And we're going to get into a discussion today about something that I have been working around the edges on, not frankly understanding like we've talked about many times in the past. But let's get to that. Dr. Smith, can I call you Dr. Smith? Should I call you Richard? What should I call you?
Richard would be great. And quick clarification, Andrew, I am the chairman and CEO of the Foundation for the Study of Cycles, not the founder. Our founder was Edward Dewey, who founded the foundation about 80 years ago now.
Different from the guy who discovered the decimal system.
Yes, different than that.
Totally different.
Okay. There's been a few.
Okay. So tell me about your background, because I know, you know, you have a pretty interesting story in terms of your interest and how you got involved in the area of investing. And I thought I would ask you to share that with us.
Love to. So it was 98, 99. I was actually working on my PhD in the mathematics of uncertainty. So my dissertation was on how to help scientists and researchers be more honest about the uncertainty in their models, especially when you're kind of trying to quantify uncertainty and compute with uncertainty, you know, add information, update your assumptions, and come to, you know, reasonable conclusions, right? So meanwhile, the dot-com boom was going on, and I thought, hey, you know, I'm getting a PhD in the mathematics of uncertainty, yeah, and everybody else is doing it. I ought to be able to hold my own. And sure enough, I got in the markets and my account was up 300% in 12 months. And I'm patting myself on the back, you know, how smart I am. This PhD is really paying off. And then March of 2000 hit. And
like, what the hell did I spend all this money for?
More to risk than what I had read in my textbooks.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I started to really understand the behavioral and emotional side of risk. And, you know, ultimately it comes down, decision-making comes down to human beings, right? And so that started kind of a lifelong fascination with the markets, led to me starting a business which helped people build and manage their own portfolios, self-directed investors, kind of applied my background as the doctor of uncertainty to helping people really appreciate and work with uncertainty in the markets instead of trying to like pretend that it doesn't exist, you know? I find so much of what goes on with investors is really about having bad expectations or unrealistic expectations about how markets work and what their experience is likely to be, right? So I've just been fascinated not only with how we use mathematics to, you know, make better decisions in the markets, but also how we as human beings make decisions. You know, people used to say early on about my work that I take the emotion out of investing. And I really appreciate that. And I think that it's true, you know, I think that there's actually what we're trying to do is get rid of the superficial emotions in investing,
right,
the fear and greed emotions in investing, and actually uncover some longer term, more enduring emotions about, you know, why we're really in the markets, what we're trying to do here, what is a good outcome for us. And so, you know, I think investing actually should be a little more emotional than people are making it out to be. You know, like what we do with our capital matters, what our values are matter. And if you have capital, you're an influencer. And, you know, you are actually influencing the future with your capital allocation, not just, you know, trying to gamify the future.
So now, so when you're talking
really,
about,
it's all fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, you're dealing with a lot of behavioral finance, right? You're dealing with this whole idea of the human, experience and the human element of the emotions of, oh my God, I'm up. Oh my God, I'm down. Oh, how great I am now. Like you had in 2000 or prior to 2000. Right.
I
relate this to everybody's heard of this, my swordfish story that I recently had 2-3 weeks ago. I went out sword fishing and for 4 hours with this 300-pound beast on the line, it was euphoric. It was incredibly the adrenaline was pumping and it was just like this out-of-body experience. And then when it spit the hook, instant depression. very similar, right?
And look, there's no way to get around that. It's not like you could have been Spock, you know, working that Marlin, right? Like you are, you know, we're not Spock.
Right.
And it's part of it. So how do we actually, you know, take the best of mathematics and a quantitative reasoned approach, but also really, you know, take the whole investor into consideration, right?
But how does this now, I hate to say these words, but it's a little bit different right now than it was back in the 90s and even in the early 2000s where we had a lot of, there always isn't, always will be a lot of herds going on, but there was a lot less algorithmic trading going on. You had trade desks, you had humans against humans. Right now we have, you know, Big Blue against humans, whereas the algorithms are manifesting this fear and greed in order to capitalize on it with pretty much unlimited capital to influence the market. So now the influencers aren't playing against the influencers. Is there a difference in how we should be looking at things now?
That's a great point. And I do think that the markets today are different. I think that we're still figuring out what the meaning of those differences are. And I think it points to one of the big decisions that investors have to make is what time frame do you really care about? You know, I think, you know, over my career of helping retail investors, and by the time I exited the business I founded, we had 30,000 customers tracking over $20 billion of assets on our platform.
Wow.
And, you know, so I've, been in touch with a lot of retail investors, you know, I've seen the best and the worst, in myself and in others. Right. And, you know, again, I think it goes back to having, accurate expectations. And a big part of that is what is your time frame? You know, are you thinking in days? Are you thinking in weeks? Are you thinking in months, years, or decades?
I mean, there's a big difference because these days, I mean, minutes are what used to be the old days, and days are what the old weeks, and weeks are the old months, right? And things are changing so quickly. I mean, this is often the case, and I got to tell you, from my observation at least, what I've seen, and you tell me what you think, is when we have big government involved in some decision-making that is involved with primarily the financial system, the economic base, we get these incredibly wide swings up or down. And almost on every occasion that we've seen this, it's been very similar outcome where whether it goes up or down is not the point, but the volatility. Yeah. And then the other point is, I think, and I may ask you about this, is it's not only time frame, but it's how much at risk during different periods. Because you could have a 5-year time frame, like, I like this stock. It looks like it's going to do great.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, it drops down 20% and all of a sudden your time frame of 5 years is like, oh man.
Yeah.
So hell with that. This is no good. I'm out of this thing. Right. As opposed to if you stuck with your 5-year time frame, you'd say, you know, maybe I should buy some more at this cheaper price here.
You know, I think one of the big differences between professionals and amateurs is professionals think about how much they're willing to lose. And amateurs only think about how much they hope to win.
Ah, that's interesting. So they don't see that other side of the equation because there's
and
something.
And I think that's the key because one of my early mentors, I asked him, this was Jake Bernstein. I don't know if you're familiar with him or not. But I said, hey, Jake, what's the difference between the winners and the losers? And he said, the winners don't need the money.
Yeah. Well, It's always the case, right? That's like on the golf course, right? I am so good on the driving range.
Yep.
But I get out to that first tee. I'm like, what? Well, how did that happen? I hit every single ball in the driving range perfectly. And then you get out there and you do it. Or for those people that bringing this into and expressing this into the financial area, you know, people who do paper trading and they do fine for a month. And then the first trade out of the gate, they lose a ton of money.
Exactly. So how do we put ourselves in a position where we're, you know, not getting stressed out by the markets? Because the markets, you know, that's what they do. They're designed to take advantage of stressing people out. you know, especially when you're focused on short-term timeframes, right? And so, you know, I know one of the things we wanted to talk about is TikTok and what's going on there. But, you know, I've increasingly seen a connection between how financial markets work, the very issues that we're talking about, and how social media markets have come to work. Okay. So it's the same kind of machine-driven algorithms that induce anxiety in, you know, most of the people that interact with them, and induce emotional stress, you know, which keeps you kind of flat-footed, not knowing what to do, and ultimately, you know, vulnerable to having your pockets picked. That's what goes on in markets, and that's what's going on in the social media world.
Do you think do you think that's purposely done by the creators? I mean,
I don't think they started out with that intention, but I think that's what it has become. And if you are familiar with the work with the surveillance capitalism thesis, I don't know if you've come across this yet or if you've seen
The
Social Dilemma on Netflix.
Yep.
This is serious stuff, you know, and I think it's very important topic for there to be more dialogue and more discussion, you know, at a societal level about, you know, what kind of future we want for ourselves, for our children, because I think you kind of take the power of social media, the power, and not just social media, but the power of a Google, you know, the power of Facebook, that, and the power of Citadel Securities on the financial side, right? Mm-hmm. They have so much computing power, so much data, and you know they're able to outgun everyone.
It's a very sad situation.
And social media, you know, I mean, Google is publicly traded, Facebook's publicly traded, Twitter's publicly traded, right? They're all driven by, shareholder profits. And I'm a big fan of capitalism, but you know, there's something here that we need to look at.
Well, you're a fan of capitalism.
I don't have all the answers, but I got a lot of questions.
Yeah. You're a fan of capitalism, right? But you're not a fan of capitalism at any cost.
Right.
Right.
Right. And not like, captured capitalism or, you know, crony capitalism. Right. And part of the surveillance capitalism thesis is really interesting. It's kind of, if you look back to the early kind of 2000s, there was this, you know, 9/11 happened. So there was this kind of panic in the national security establishment about how do we find a needle in a haystack? And Google was developing their behavioral technology, really, to, you know, to better predict the behavior of their users, right? You had this massive acquisition of data, this massive, you know, exponential increase in computing power. And so, you know, the government and the markets kind of all came together and said, hey, you know, we got to do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it has served its purpose, and I think it's provided some tremendous benefits that, you know, I'm not trying to deny. But at the same time, I think when you see things like, you know, suicide rates in teenage girls increasing, you know, doubling, tripling, you have to reassess and you have to say, hey, is there something we need to tweak here? And I think that's where the TikTok story comes in.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it's an incredibly powerful technology that hasn't been fully appreciated how powerful it is and how easily weaponized it is. So I personally think that Trump is correct in raising these issues to a national security level issue.
But wait, hold on a second. Richard, let me ask you a question. First of all, I think I have the solution for how we won't be swayed and sucked in and have the FOMO with various forms of social media. And that is just take off the filter and take off the edit feature from a photo, and everybody will see what's really going on. Mm-hmm. You follow what I'm saying? I mean, because I want to live the Instagram life of that guy, and I want my food to look like those, and I want to be on vacation in that incredible blue lagoon, which could have, by the way, started out as a brown swamp before they were done.
Absolutely.
But let's talk about TikTok in a way because, first of all, let's differentiate.
Yep.
What is the difference between a TikTok, which is no different than the old Vine was, that is no longer in existence, right? Short form video, people putting that together, some of them very funny, very interesting, some of them stupid as hell. But what is the implication and the differential between TikTok, let's say, and an Instagram?
Well, I think what's clear is that TikTok has a very powerful formula, artificial intelligence, that is working. So it's attracting a tremendous number of users. I think some information just came out. They have 100 million active users in the United States.
Right.
That's unbelievable.
It's a third.
Right?
It's a third.
And advertisers are reaching their target audiences in ways that they're more successful doing that than on any other platform right now. So, I forget the type of advertising this is called at the moment,
native,
but
native,
it has this sense of authenticity.
Yeah, the native.
You know, the user-based advertising, when your users essentially advocate for you, right?
Right.
And so, you know, the bottom line is TikTok is getting results, and that's why it's drawn the attention that it has.
So now, if TikTok was owned by Germany, would we be having this discussion?
I don't think we would, because I think that, you know, the United States and China are somewhat of the world power poles today.
Right.
And, you know, there's definitely an adversarial relationship there that is not there with our NATO allies.
So how is it? This is the area that gets me confused.
Yep.
How is it that we have a company that is, let's just say, owned in China? Well, forget about the exact owners for a moment and how much the China state owns of it and all that, but it's owned in China and it's now released here and it's very popular here and the rest of the world as well. Mm-hmm. How is it that our government is expecting to force a sale of the TikTok or the portion of the United States version of TikTok or some other kind of oversight through Oracle, and I don't even forget about Walmart. Let's just put them out of the discussion for a second here. Next we're going to have Clorox getting a piece of TikTok, right? But how is it that our government expects that China is going to go along with this, especially because they own a piece of this company? It makes zero sense to me in a capitalistic society how we go along and do that.
I think one of the big issues is where the data resides, and having Oracle be the essentially repository of that data, I think, is one of the things that meets the Trump administration's national security concerns. And I think that's a really important point. Look, there's a lot of gray area here, but we live in somewhat unprecedented times and we're having to figure things out for the first time. And what's pretty clear to me is that this social media technology is immensely powerful. I don't think people fully appreciate how powerful it is. I don't think people fully appreciate how it can be weaponized. So let me explain what I mean by weaponized. This is a very powerful technology. It has an immense amount of data. It has an immense amount of computing power, and it has an immense amount of historical data that really understands us better than we understand ourselves. Mm. And You know, I think that it's really interesting about sort of the parallels between what I know you've experienced in the financial markets, what I've experienced in financial markets, and what people who have kind of matured in the financial markets, let's say, can bring to the table to this conversation. You know, it is a lot like having to fight back against all of the, you know, distractions and diversions, right?
Yeah,
sure. That take place in the capital markets.
Right.
And so it's fascinating to me how those of us who have, you know, been through those battles, I think potentially, you know, have something to contribute to the conversation about how these markets could be a little less mercenary. You know, it's one thing when a bunch of market participants get together and say, okay, you know, here's the ground rules. We all understand what we're getting into and let's go, right? It's another thing when these technologies and these tactics are, you know, being targeted at people that don't realize what they're up against.
So what is going to be the end product of this? I mean, is there going to be either, I mean, China said that no way, we're not doing this deal, right? Oracle's all excited about it. And then what's the upside of this? I mean, is this going to be a split? I mean, first of all, the idea of giving the government $5 billion as a kickback on the side seems ridiculous.
I think that's sort of fallen by the wayside.
Yeah. And then
thankfully.
Yeah. I guess the hope is that Oracle will be the gatekeeper of information, kind of a walled garden of the information on US users, I suppose. Right.
Yep.
And then assuming people don't use VPNs and don't do strange things and somehow the data doesn't go outside of the U.S. somehow, but the data, which would be their likes, what they did, where the location is, what they're interested in, kind of like the blueprint of all the things that advertisers want. And then they'll do that for the U.S.-based portion of it. And then there's some other discussion about an IPO down the road of that, which is going to be called, I think, TikTok Global. Does that mm-hmm. solve the problem?
Look, I think these are new issues that we're going to be wrestling with for a long time. I don't think we should be thinking about this in terms of solving a problem today. I think these are new conversations. These are new issues being raised. And there are new concerns that nation states and social media users have to spend some time navigating through. So I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg here. I think this is going to become increasingly, a conversation that's going on globally. I think, you know, this is kind of the front lines of the cyber Cold War.
You know, you have to wonder if this goes through and this becomes some kind of a blueprint, if we're going to see countries like, I don't know, pick your country, you know, Argentina, Vietnam, you know, anywhere, Europe somewhere is going to say, hey, you know what? You know, we think that's a really good idea. We don't want the U.S. having our data through Facebook. Now, we may say it's different because Facebook's a private entity and they don't share the data, but still, they may not see that way because it would be a way for them to leverage the idea that the information is stored in the U.S. and therefore is possibly able to be only utilized that way, and therefore may require some of these companies like the Googles and the Facebooks and the Twitters and LinkedIn and whoever else to do that. I mean, that could backfire pretty dramatically on our companies, right?
Yes, it could. I think, though, that China and the U.S. are the two, 800-pound gorillas in the room. And I think the bigger risk is that the internet kind of fractures into two poles.
Hmm.
And, you know, I don't think smaller countries really have the luxury, you know, that the U.S. and China do in terms of, you know, their network effects.
Right.
So you got to be part of some, you know, bigger network that you can enjoy those network effect benefits on. And we'll see where this goes. You know,
so
I think it's going to be a conversation that's with us for a long time.
Yeah. So this question, though, I do need to ask this one question. Do you think that this is going to be a situation that is politically that has an aspect of political motivation involved in it, running up to the election, with all the things that we've been pounding the table on, and President Trump has been, and his administration about China.
Yep.
What if we get to the other side of November, and there is a now new administration, and Vice President Biden wins somehow?
Yep.
Is this going to just peter out and be like, okay, great, this was a good idea, but we're not going to follow up? Or is this going to be something that's going to continue pretty intensely?
I think there's no doubt that politics has clouded this issue, but I don't think the issue is going away. I don't think it's going to go away in a Biden administration. Certainly not going to go away in four more years of a Trump administration. And I think it's something that's going to be on the table for a while.
All right. And the last question I have about this, if this was not a state-owned enterprise partially or somewhat, right, by mm-hmm. Dance, and it's not necessarily that manner of holding, even though it's still in China, would it be as big of a deal? Or is the concern that the government now has access?
I think it's the concern that the government has access. Right. And let me say that, you know, I think ByteDance and its founder really don't want to be a part of this, you know, fight, right? So yeah. I think, you know, they've done some pretty interesting things. I think there was, you know, they've formed advisory boards that help them really look at, you know, some of the more sensitive issues around social media. I think they really want to genuinely be a part of the global community. And I think that they're working hard to do that. But I think you take WeChat, for example, and that one is much more closely aligned with the Communist Party directly mm-hmm. and, you know, and openly and overtly so. And I think it raises issues that that, like I said, people are going to be talking about.
It's going to be interesting. Thanks, Dr. Richard Smith. We're going to have the information on where to get your more information at richardsmith.com and cycles.org. And again, the founder and chairman of the board of the Foundation for the Study of Cycles. I love that name. Just there's something about it. It's classy. It's something.
It
about
is.
It. Yeah, it's classy.
Thank
I
you.
Like it.
Check us out at cycles.org. We're a 501c3 not-for-profit. And Edward Dewey, who was the founder of the foundation, was very concerned with human behavior. And so it's a theme that, you know, continues to be an important part of the foundation's legacy today.
All right. Great stuff. We'll do it again. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thank you, Andrew.
All right.
Bye.
So there you have it. Kind of start off with the whole discussion about all the things that are going on in the world and the idea of how we deal with it and how we process it and how it's creating misery for millions of people. I mean, the fact is that the depression rates are up. The prescription drug for fighting all sorts of depression are up. And we're seeing that more and more people, due to the fact of the change of their lifestyle and everything involved, inclusive of that in-your-face news, social media, and the algos that are there to pull you in, are creating this environment. So I think it was really good that we had Dr. Smith on to talk about some of the issues related to that, how we deal with it with the idea of investing, and also about what's happening with this TikTok deal and how it's going to possibly play out. Well, we're going to end it right there. I want to thank you for joining me. Of course, we'll be on DH Unplugged this week at 9 p.m. Myself and John C. Dvorak live. You can also find that on every podcast service that's out there. And other than that, I'll see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.